Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 7th of May. Our guest this hour is a great reporter, and get ready for a wonderful hour because we've had him on a couple times before, and he's got a lot to say. David K. Johnston is with us, an investigative journalist and author. He was senior tax reporter with the New York Times for a number of years and is an independent author and reporter right now. He's the author of best-selling books on tax and economic policy. The most recent is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Also, Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else. He's winner of the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Best Reporting. Beat reporting for stories that exposed loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. His current piece looks at retirement and looks at ERISA and also looks at what he says is this great inequity that we have people who are former executives who are assured that their pensions are going to be A-OK, making incredible amounts of money, while you and me may be in fear of losing our pensions entirely and have to fight to keep them. There's a lot going on with this, and he writes in the current issue of Mother Jones about pension privateers and looks at the complex ways that Washington is taking money from you and from me, but others are doing okay. So our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. David, hello, and thank you once again for being with us.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. You start the article with a story about Jon Snow, who was George W. Bush's second Treasury Secretary, who took this huge annual pension. Start with his story and how it's relevant to this discussion.
Well, under federal law since 1974, companies have had to set aside money for your pension. And under these rules, your pension is a formula, if you have one, based on your salary times the years that you worked for the company. And the company may not, by law, pay you any more than that formula. So if you work 25 years and the formula is 1% a year, you'll get 25% of the salary you earned, the average of your last usually 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Snow worked for 25 years and got a pension based on 44 years of work.
Whoa.
It counted not just his base salary and not even just his bonus or long-term performance awards, but his stock and his stock options.
Mm.
That is, everything they could possibly throw into the mix went to the benefit of Mr. Snow. And on top of all of this, when Jon Snow was leader of the company, he insisted that every worker at the company should own stock, even if you're a janitor. You had to buy a lot of stock in the company, and that way you would be vested in making the company do well. Well, for a while, the company's stock went up, and Mr. Snow's share was purchased with money loaned to him by the company. And then the stock price started to fall, and lo and behold, Mr. Snow was allowed to return his stock, even though it was worth far less than his loans, and undo the deal.
Ooh. And what about everybody else?
They had their stock.
Hmm. So how could this executive, and it's not just this executive, there are many others, get away with this kind of deal? Didn't ERISA deal with that in that 74 law, or they excluded executive pensions, or what?
Well, here's what happens. The ERISA law, and this is mostly the fault, I would argue, of the Democrats, limits the amount in a pension subject to ERISA, that is, that has to be funded in advance and protected. The limit is a little under $250,000. Now, 98% of all workers make less than $250,000. So you would think, well, we've taken care of 98% of the problem. You've actually created a problem. Senior executives who make, you know, $2 million, $10 million, $20 million, there are many of them now out there making $100 million a year, no longer have a financial interest in that pension. Because if your pension's based on $10 million a year, and you're getting your retirement plan that's in that government-protected plan based on $250,000, you're talking about a tiny fraction of 1% of the money. So executives have separate plans. These plans are not protected by the government. But back in 1996, when I was at the New York Times, my colleague Diana Henriquez and I went through the records of a series of big companies that went bankrupt. And what we showed was that the workers at these companies lost some or all of their pensions because they were underfunded. And if they had defined contribution plans, the kind of 401k-type plans people have now,
right,
many of them, because they were forced to be in company stock, lost 95 cents on the dollar of their retirement savings.
Mm.
But the executives in these supposedly risky plans, Kathleen, got 100 cents on the dollar or more.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Now, is this what you're talking about when you use these words, top hat plans?
Yes, they're called top hat plans on the idea that, you know, executives or plutocrats wear top hats, sort of a historical image. And these are plans above the regular pension plan. If you're an executive who's making millions a year, you still get this. If there's a pension plan, you still get the government-guaranteed pension plan everybody else gets. But then you get this additional top hat or supplemental executive retirement plan, SERP. They come under various names, but basically they are pension plans for those above the government limits. And at some companies, IBM is a good example, once you're a salary goes above the level of Social Security. You know, your Social Security this year will, if you make more than about $6,000, you will no longer pay Social Security taxes. You actually get a higher formula to increase your pension above that amount.
Hmm. And then when it comes to taxes, you talk about the fact that companies have to pay taxes on the money they put into these top hat plans. But they've got all these shelters, so they wind up not doing so?
Yes. When companies contribute to the ERISA plans, the ones that apply to 98% of workers, that money is deducted as a business expense, which means the company makes less profit, which means that the company's stock price is lower and the executive's options are worth less. When companies put money into executive plans, they don't get to deduct them. So to put in $100 million would cost $135 million, the $100 million plus the tax on the $100 million. Well, when companies do this and set money aside, it bloats the size of the cost of these plans, because instead of being tax deductible, they're cost plus tax. Well, when you have a company that puts aside large sums of money every year for this into a trust, lo and behold, what happens is it squeezes the company's personnel budget. So the executives go to the workers and they say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, because of competition, we are going to have to scale back your health care plan, or we're going to have to eliminate your pension plan, or reduce the benefits going forward. You used to be getting 1.25% of your salary. Well, the future years, you're going to only get 1% of your salary. What they don't tell them is it's not competition from the company down the street or across the country. It's competition from the executive suite.
Oh, my gosh. And if workers were more aware of that, there would be even more trouble in some of the companies in this country, right?
Yes. And one of the things I find most amazing about this is that although I have written about this before, although this one I think is a nice, short, concise explanation of this in Mother Jones, unions never seem to have really caught on to this. They don't seem to understand this sort of fine print very well. And I've gone and spoken to, for example, UAW and meetings and airline union worker meetings, and people are astonished. And I think, how is it that your leaders aren't telling you this? What is it that they don't get? Whereas I know on the other side of the table, on the management side, they have huge budgets to hire compensation consultants, lawyers, actuaries, and others to advise them on how to make sure that the executives do as well as possible, even if it comes out of the hides of the people whose work makes the company successful.
Oh, I bet once people hear you speak, David, they start taking some action.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would imagine they do. What's this deal about the Social Security swindle?
Well, ERISA, when it was adopted in 1974, allowed companies to offset your pension with your Social Security check. And there were people who ended up thinking they were going to get a pension when they retired, mostly lower paid workers, clerks, janitors, maybe secretaries. And when they went to retire, they discovered that some or even all of their pension went away because of the Social Security offset. Now, in 1986, Congress changed the law. And what did they do? Well, they said you can only lose half your pension. Now, think about this. We're trying to get people to save and have income in their old age.
Mm-hmm.
We talk in this country about a three-legged stool for retirement: Social Security, pensions, and private savings. When you have a pension plan, it is simply current wages that you gave up that are being invested for your old age. So when there's an offset, that means you didn't get your full wages, whereas people who didn't have the offset affect them did not. And all Congress did was allow companies to steal half the wages you set aside instead of potentially 100% of them.
Hmm. Is anybody looking at updating ERISA? This was 35 years ago.
Well, ERISA is constantly being updated. Now, this article in Mother Jones in the current issue is sort of a precursor of one of the chapters in my next book, which will be out next year, The Fine Print.
Mm.
And that is about how, you know, people have a headline understanding something. If you have a pension, it is guaranteed by the federal government. Well, no, as little as 15% of it is guaranteed. And that's because there have been lobbyists from big companies in there working for years and years and years to change this rule and change that rule and make things complicated. And when you hear politicians, you know, say, or pundits on TV talk about how incredibly complex regulation is, well, yeah, it's because instead of having simple, straightforward rules, corporations, and by that I mean campaign donors who are renting members of Congress for their bidding, are constantly in there getting this and that little provision put in, which will get them benefits at your expense.
We're going to welcome phone calls for David. We're going to have a lot of them, I'm sure. The current article, if you'd like to look it up and read it while we're talking or after we're through, or maybe you've read it already, is in the current issue of Mother Jones, Pension Privateers. And that web is MotherJones, all one word, .com. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David K. Johnston, our guest. Let's go to phone calls. And to Jeff from Eau Claire is our first caller. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I have a question about the Social Security taxes. You mentioned there's a ceiling, and to me, it just seems logical that you would probably want to tax that money for people, and aren't they getting Social Security? Do they like not get a? Is there a certain limit on Social Security that you can receive if you make a lot of money, or what?
Well, the Social Security, Jeff, is limited based on the cap on contributions, which is this year you pay Social Security tax, and your employer matches that tax, so the total tax is more than 13%. You pay that on the first, I think it's $106,000 this year of your salary. And your Social Security is capped. If you made the max every year for 35 years, because they count 35 years, your Social Security check would be based on this. Now, it turns out Social Security did a study, and I think I'm the only person who's reported on this, that examined benefits and work. And it found that workers in the top quartile of pay, the top quarter of pay, over 35 years, on average, spent less than one 90-day period out of work. 99.9% of the time, they got some pay every 90 days. The second quartile, 99.8%. But in the bottom quartile of workers, people were out of work, on average, 11.9 years out of 35.
Hmm.
So
Thanks very much for your call, Jeff. Let's go next to Linda from Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Mr. Johnston.
Morning. Just David.
All right, David. I've read two of your books, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and they sure made a lot of sense, common sense to me. While I agree with you on the disappearing 401ks, what I'm really disappointed in is what I hear could happen to our Social Security cost of living, according to the Wisconsin State Journal, which said that we're not going to get a cost of living increase for the next few years. Now, I think it's really going to be hard to take with the cost of everything going up. Now, I'm wondering what we can do as senior citizens, other than talk to AARP and our legislators and you, to reverse this direction that things are going, that is, that the middle class is getting eliminated. What's your opinion?
Well, Linda, a couple of things about this. The reason Social Security this year is not going up at all is that we don't have inflation as measured by the government. In fact, from March of 2008 to March of 2009, overall, prices actually fell. And by the way, a deflation is a much scarier thing than an inflation. That's the reason that you didn't get an increase. On the other hand, the amount of money that you have to pay for your share of Medicare charges has gone up. So when the government says, well, you're not getting an increase because that's for cost of living and there is no increase in the cost of living, guess what? The government increased your cost of health care, and you mandatorily have to pay it if you're going to get health care. So, in fact, it did give you a pay cut. This has been a fundamental trend going on in our society for a long time. The median wages, that is half above, half below of workers, measured by the Social Security Medicare tax, are unchanged now for a couple of decades, virtually unchanged. And yet they've had to go from having a top salary category of $5 million up to $10 million to $20 million and now to $50 million because all of the increase going on is at the top. And this is a fundamental issue of how the laws and rules were rewritten over the last 30 years of the Reaganism era, which includes Bill Clinton, to skew all these subtle, fine rules to benefit the people at the very top at the expense of everybody else. And, I complained to Congress. The issue I would raise with Congress is not that you're not going to get an increase in your Social Security check, but you shouldn't pay more for your Medicare portion if you don't get an increase in your Social Security check.
Thanks for the call. I want to make sure we cover what's in the article as well. 40 is the new 60. Since 85, more and more companies have switched from traditional guaranteed benefit pensions to a new system called a cash balance plan, you write. What is that plan, and does it amount to illegal age discrimination, do you think?
I do. The courts don't. Kathleen, what happened is this. Normally, in a defined benefit pension plan, every year you work, you get a benefit, and the typical formula to make it simple would be 1% times the number of years you work for the company times your salary. So if it's 1%, you work 20 years, you get 20% of your salary when you retire. And you're guaranteed that money. Now, the other kind of plan, a 401k plan, the company may put in money, you save out of your own paycheck in any event, you decide how to invest it, and you go undertake the risks of investing. And if it was easy to invest, the average job on Wall Street wouldn't pay $660,000 a year. And when I say that figure, I'm including janitors and secretaries in the numbers. So there's a hybrid plan, a sort of combination of these. The company sets aside a specific amount of money every year, either a flat dollar amount or a percentage of your pay, and they guarantee you a rate of return, let's say 5% a year. So if the company puts aside $5,000 a year for you, you work for the company for 10 years, you'll have $50,000, and they will have paid you each year 5% interest on that balance, and you'll have whatever that works out to be, $60-some thousand probably. The problem is that companies did this when they had large numbers of workers in their 40s and 50s. And if you are in a traditional pension, most of the benefits you get come from the number of years you work. You can end up with half your benefit coming from your last 10 years on the job if you get big pay raises in those years. And so this was a way to reduce spending. Typically, companies cut their spending when they did this by at least 20%. And the people who lost out were older workers, because in this kind of a plan where there's a guaranteed rate of return rather than an earned benefit, the time value of the money, the magic of compound interest, is really important. Compound interest after 10 or 15 years on the job is very small. Compound interest after 40 years on the job is very big. So this was simply a way for companies to provide a form of pay cut to their workers. IBM workers sued over this. They said it's age discrimination, and the court said, no, it's not.
Let's go to Kate from Milwaukee. Hello, Kate.
Hello. I thought this applied when I called it in. Based on what you were saying with the companies taking the top crop, taking the cream of the crop on pay, the top executives and whatnot, holding on to what they want in pay and cutting the little guy. If you have, I just got a letter last week. I'm not retired yet, but I have an early retirement from a company. And we just got a letter last week stating they're giving a report on the condition of the pension fund and how well it's funded, showing it's down to like 9.2% fully funded instead of 100%.
9.2, under 10%? Or 92%?
It might be 92%. It's down from what it... Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Does that relate to what you were saying? So the top is holding on to what they want, but cutting the little guy, is that affecting these pension funds that are going down?
Linda, here's what that probably means. Companies, and my article talks about this in Mother Jones, companies used to invest all of their pension money in bonds, maybe a little bit in real estate that acted like bonds. And if you go to go buy an annuity, that's a single-person individual pension plan, and the insurance company that would sell it to you would say, here's how old you are. We calculate here's how much we're going to pay you. We have an actuarial table that tells us how long you're going to live, and they do that, of course, across thousands of people, so you may live longer or shorter, but as a group, you will all live that age. They're very good at predicting that. And they then buy a portfolio of bonds. And as these bonds pay interest and are redeemed because their time period comes to an end, it generates enough cash to pay you. And then at the end, the company has a profit. Well, companies have been investing their money in the stock market. The stock market over the long haul may produce bigger returns, but because pension plans have to pay money out every month, when the stock market falls, as it has in this country, by about half, what happens then is there's a big drain on the remaining resources. The company now doesn't have enough money to pay the full amount, and it either has to put more money into the plan, or it has to shut the plan down and in some cases turn it over to the government. And people who have an early retirement provision where you can leave at 55, for example, as if you were 65 years old, discover if the plan fails that the federal guarantee is awful, and they get a huge cut in their monthly checks.
Thanks for the call. And so factor in what would have happened. So many people have lost so much money. What would have happened if this whole privatization, and it's always under the surface of Social Security, ever took place, and all that money had been lost in Social Security, too? People would be dirt poor, wouldn't they?
It would be an absolute disaster. And, you know, when you hear people say, you hear all sorts of politicians and interest groups saying, you know, there's this huge multi-trillion-dollar liability for Social Security in the future, and we can't afford that. Well, you know what? I don't think we can afford public education anymore, Kathleen. Do you realize if you look over the next 75 years at the cost of public education and you reduce it to the equivalent of a single lump sum payment today, which is what these advocates do with Social Security, how much it would cost? It would bankrupt America. We better shut down kindergarten and elementary schools and just give that all up right now because we can't afford it.
Andy from Racine, hi.
How you doing, Kathleen?
All right, Andy, how are you?
I had a kind of question for your guest here. That I am a senior citizen. I've received Medicare. I'm retired, but I still work part-time. And when President Obama was campaigning, I think I heard him say that he was going to try to do something about it because he thought it wasn't fair that Social Security should be taxed. The way I understand it is Like if you work part-time to kind of make your meet what you have to do, if you earn over $5,000, then you have to pay taxes on Social Security.
Let me explain that to you. How old are you, Andy?
I'm going to be 69.
Okay. If you're over 65 years old, you can earn all you want to earn, and you will not be you will not have your Social Security benefit reduced. If you retire before the age of 65, you can lose a lot of money. I think it's $1 for three above a certain threshold. But so you can work, first of all. You'll have to pay income taxes and Social Security taxes on those earnings, which will also affect your benefits from Social Security, and they'll get recalculated, number one. Number two, if you earn more than a certain amount of money, I think it's $32,000 or so if you're a married couple, then 85% of your Social Security taxes currently are subject to being taxed. Now, given that you pay into Social Security with taxes and then take back out later, the idea that this is income or economic gain and you should be taxed on it is outrageous. But this was put in place as one of the measures during the Reagan years to cover up all of the tax breaks going to people at the very top and balance the budget. It was shifting the burden. That's what my book, Perfectly Legal, explained a couple of years ago. All these mechanisms that shifted the burden. Obama has proposed that if you are a senior citizen, which I presume he means 65 or older, or maybe 66 or older, you would not pay any income taxes until your income reaches $50,000. It seems to me that a better solution would be to say your Social Security benefits are tax-free. That would eliminate the problem overwhelmingly for older Americans.
Did you have something else, Andy?
Yeah. So when is this going to start? Because I think Obama wanted to do something about that.
Well, you got to get Congress to do it. You know, Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution gives Congress the power to tax, not the president. The president can propose. So what I would suggest you do, if you think this is important, is you should be getting you and all your friends to write pointed brief letters to your congressmen and your senators saying, when are you going to enact President Obama's $50,000 tax, you know, before taxes apply to senior citizens law? And, you know, when politicians all do one thing, they get up in the morning and they wet a finger and they hold it up to the wind to see which way the political wind is blowing. And if they detect that lots of their constituents are demanding this, trust me, they will act. But if they think you don't really care, it's not even important enough for people to call and write letters, then they're going to keep doing what they're doing, which is taking care of their campaign contributors.
Thank you, Andy, for your call. Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Excellent guest.
He's great, isn't he?
I don't know if this is completely helpful, but having starting to reach a certain age, I've noticed over the last 30 years that there has been a long-term project. If you look at attitudes that are projected into the culture, there's an increase in the idea of compensation. The meritorious should be getting more. And it's been combined with also a culture of resentment. Somewhere out there, there are people who are getting things which they do not deserve, generally people associated with unions or the poor or single mothers. And this was combined with a demand that capital should return more than it had in the past. So this starts about 1980. And the culture of compensation was that for the people at the top, the resentment was directed down, and anything that didn't perform on a spreadsheet that to increase return, the apparent return, was not virtuous. And you can make that argument, and mutual insurance companies became private, this type of thing. So is this going to be reversed in the absence of a general demand for change? And that has to be directed at the politicians. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Bye.
Thanks.
Well, Frank is exactly right about this, and I would
direct this at sort of three key figures in American life. Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, brilliant man, but like many brilliant people, also had crackpot ideas, like he wanted to eliminate all public parks because that was the socialist misuse of government's power.
Oh,
so if you're
goodness.
A little child and you don't have the money to pay for or buy a ticket, you can't play on the swing. He was Ronald Reagan's chief financial advisor. Ronald Reagan was the second big player. And the third player was Jack Welch at General Electric, who you'll recall was called Neutron Jack almost 30 years ago for firing about 100,000 workers and saying that not one penny or $1 of GE's assets can be unproductive. Of course, when he retired and was not did not have any role at the company whatsoever, he was retired. He had a Boeing 737 jet and a multimillion dollar apartment and memberships in 24 golf courses and other stuff all provided to him until I explained the economics of this in a story in the New York Times, at which point he relinquished all of that. But Frank is exactly right. And that's what my books, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, explain to people in plain English in great detail. The article in Mother Jones is about an aspect of this, which is your retirement money and how the system has been set up to make sure that those at the top are taken care of at your expense. And when my book, The Fine Print, comes out next year, it will have that and many other devices that are like this. But that's what's fundamentally been going on. Conversions of nonprofits to for-profit status, whether they're mutual insurance companies or health plans, the turning over of public property to private individuals, the provision of such massive subsidies that whole industries get all of their profits from hidden subsidies that people don't see.
Let's go to another call. Ben is next from Madison. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I'm calling about the estate taxes. I heard that the recent budget proposal from Obama wants to freeze at about $3.5 million per person, about $7 million a couple before the estate taxes are applied. But the reaction from the right is that it's going to affect the small businessmen and the survivors have to sell the small business to pay the estate taxes and so on. At the same time, I heard before this amount of PE, small business that had to be sold to pay the taxes were negligible or nil. What is the real truth on that?
Ben, I'm glad you asked about that. President Bush ran for office 9 years ago saying that we had to repeal the estate tax to save the family farm. So in the spring of or the late winter of 2001, right after he took office, I went out to the richest county in Iowa and interviewed about 24 farmers, all of them Republicans, most of them local government officials. And they literally laughed at that. The White House was unable to produce for me ever a single example of a farm lost to the estate tax. The Farm Bureau sent a panicked email out to its members saying, we've got to find an example, and they couldn't. And we don't make public policy in this country based on one case. The reality is that the average farm in America is worth far less than $3.5 million. It's worth less than $2 million. The only farmers, and I put that in quotes, who will pay estate taxes are Ted Turner, Sam Donaldson, the former ABC News anchor who gets subsidies for his mohair goat farm, and other very wealthy people who are farmers only in the sense that they own a big piece of land and call it a farm. They're not yeoman farmers out working the land or working their cows. The small business matter is a little more complicated. The government, first of all, gives you 14 years, if you have a business, to pay off the estate tax, number one. And number two, if you're trying to keep a family business going by gifting to your children, there are huge discounts available. And if you have three children and 10 years, you can transfer several million dollars of value. Very few businesses are worth more than that. In fact, I interviewed a whole bunch of car dealers and construction company owners, none of whom were near $5 million of net worth when the Democrats were offering to exempt that much money back 8 years ago. There is, however, I think, two fundamental questions to ask about the estate tax. Some people have estates that have never been taxed. If your parents gave you a gift tax-free, and you never received dividends on that, then your gains have never been taxed. And if we repealed the estate tax, your family would benefit from tax-free income. And I use Bill Gates in my book, Perfectly Legal, as the example to illustrate this. If he were to die in 2010, his fortune would never be taxed except for the shares of stock that he's already sold. On the other hand, there are people who, they have no gain in their estate. They simply have property that has not grown in value for one reason or another. They are also taxed. So one thing I think we should discuss is whether we should have capital gains taxes at death that apply only to your gains. And secondly, should we tax the estate or the beneficiary? If you inherit the money, maybe you should pay the tax. You get $1 million when grandpa dies. That's $1 million of income. You pay taxes on $1 million. But the notion that the estate tax is destroying small business has been thoroughly debunked. The records, most of my work is based on what's in the official record, in the statistical data, which I spend a lot of time analyzing. And, Ben, you're exactly right. A trivial amount of tax affects very few people, and the few people who it affects, simple changes in the law would eliminate those problems.
Thank you, Ben, for the call. Our guest this hour is David K. Johnston, who's written yet another great piece in Mother Jones, this one is, and it's titled Fiscal Therapy. I guess the overall thrust of it is how he ends the piece. What we have now is a situation where there are nearly 44 million workers at risk of not being paid the benefits they are due in pensions, this is, but few executives will miss out on their golden years. And he outlines in the article why that is the case. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we have pretty busy lines. Send an email if you'd like. We're using that. That's talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. David is an investigative journalist and author, senior tax reporter with the New York Times for something like 13, 14 years. He's now an independent author and reporter. He's working on a new book. He is author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, and Perfectly Legal, the Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now. And we go to Mary from Black River Falls. Thanks for waiting, Mary. Hi.
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 I wanted to use this opportunity, you're the person who answered the phone, said it's okay that I do this, to give your listeners a couple of really good resources in terms of assistance to pensioners. There's two websites. One is www.pensionrights.org. It's run by an agency in Washington, D.C. that's existed for 30 years to provide advocacy on the part of pension recipients and people who will be eventually getting pensions. They also have a website called pensionhelp.org that provides a lot of information about where to go to get assistance. And also specifically to Wisconsin residents, the Upper Midwest Pension Rights Project is a place where you can get free claims assistance or answers to your pension questions. And I don't have the phone number. I'm in my car right now. But if you go on the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups website, which I believe is www.cwag.org, you can get a link to the project, to project information and the phone number. And I just want to say I'm a plaintiff's attorney in ERISA, so it's been really delightful on this cross-country trip that I can listen to this information. I'm following it very closely, and every time you say something, it's like, it's a new topic. It's like, oh, yeah, an issue. And
you were listening to the right station at the right time, weren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for all of those resources.
You're welcome.
David?
Well, the Pension Rights Center does just yeoman work on these issues. They're very lightly funded. They have very, very good people working there who are trying to contend and stand, you know, this is a real David and Goliath story. You have this huge corporate lobbying operation trying to weaken pensions and the rules in pensions and skew the rules so that the companies can make it appear that you're getting a benefit when you're getting less. And the Pension Rights Center, with a staff of a half a dozen people maybe, and a lot of volunteers, has done really remarkable work trying to get out the reality of what's happening.
And thank you so much for your call. And what about this figure that I gave you? And I'm just trying to break this down a little bit. 44 million people worried about losing their pensions. How many people have already, David? How many people just, you know, got left by the wayside, pensions just non-existent?
Well, there are about 44 million people who are currently covered by some kind of a pension plan, okay? All sorts of things are being done to reduce their pensions. I have earned in my career as a newspaper man, three pensions, two of them very small. One of them I'm probably going to lose a third of because of a change made in the pension law. And all three of them are somewhat uncertain. And I'm the normal sort of case here. This is true of almost everybody because nobody is, except the Pension Rights Center and a few people like me writing about this, are talking about this. Then you have a lot of people, and I don't know how many, but there were, during the early Reagan years, many corporations shut down their pension plan and bought annuities, and they bought annuities from companies financed with Michael Milken's junk bonds. Guess what? Those insurance companies went broke. And so there were people who were expecting, as it was, minor pensions because they were like textile mill workers in the South.
Right.
And if they were supposed to get $100 a month, they're now getting $20 a month. All legal, and the guy who did the deal, of course, walked away with a fortune.
Oh, dear.
And that's the rules matter. Rules define civilization. We have rules for everything. Baseball has rules down to how many stitches are on the baseball. And what's the wealthy in America have been employing lawyers and accountants and lobbyists and actuaries to rewrite these rules you've never heard of, that thousands of pages appear in the every month in the Federal Register. And buried in those are really subtle rules. Changing one word in a regulation can be worth a fortune to somebody. And often these rules involve connecting up two things that you don't see in the same rule. You get a little change here that looks innocuous, another change 6 months later that looks innocuous, and another one the next year that looks innocuous. But the person who figured this out strings them together, and bravo, they make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. But rules have to be fair, and fairness should matter, right?
Absolutely, and that's one of the challenges to a democratic society when things are so, when our knowledge is so vast that you can't know everything. And so specialists have found out ways to make very good livings by manipulating the rules to be unfair.
We go next. Thanks, Mary, for your call. Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I guess I take offense. You know, you're being a bit divisive when you categorize people as the wealthy and the rich are doing this. And I would be considered rich by... Well, by world standards, we're all rich, but by American standards, I'm a small business owner, and it's somewhat divisive by lumping all those people together that whoever makes more than I do would be a rich or wealthy person, and blaming all society's problems on them. I own a small business with there's 10 of us, and we do not provide a pension because it just is not. Financially, I just can't do it. We do have a safe harbor 401k that we contribute to, but as a small business owner, and most people work for small businesses in the United States. I mean, that's where the majority of employment occurs, is in the small business market, and that taxation by the government that's placed upon me is astronomical. You have no clue what it's like to try and run a business, try and run a profitable business of just with 10 people, and what the government sucks out of you. We're a subchapter of
Scott, corporation. If I may?
Yeah, go ahead.
If I may, Scott, I own a business. I have two dozen employees. It's a hotel management company. I've met payrolls. I know what it's like, and I'm sure you do, when you got to reach into your own pocket to meet the payroll. It always happens at the worst possible moment, right? Well, and the rules and the regulations and the taxes that are hit upon us as small business owners, they are incredible and they're unfair. And the point I've been trying to make to people is, if you run a big multinational corporation, you can earn profits and pay little or no tax. In fact, you can make money off the income tax system that you and I pay taxes into. I've documented this thoroughly, and when I broke the story that Enron did not pay taxes, Congress, which has subpoena power, and I don't, did one of the biggest investigations in the history of Congress. They produced an 1,800-page report, and lo and behold, Enron called its tax department a profit center. They were making money. I have shown how utility companies, including ones that operate in Wisconsin, collect taxes that are embedded in the rates you pay for electricity and never turn them over to the government. Never. Not 20 years from now, but never. They pocket the money. And when that story ran on the front page of the New York Times 3 years ago, the Trade Association for the Electric Industry wrote its obligatory letter that ran on the editorial page. They didn't challenge that. They simply said, we're doing what the law provides. The system is being rigged against people like you and me, Scott, who have built up little businesses and employ people to the benefit of these big multinational corporations. And all rich people are not at all bad. I don't mean to suggest that, and I am, by any reasonable standard, a moderately wealthy man through my own hard work. I grew up poor. My dad was 100% disabled veteran, and I had to go to work when I was 13 years old. I thank in my book wealthy people who are been helpful to me, who've pointed out these things to me that they are aware of and that they may use, but they think are outrageous policy. And a system that allows companies that earn billions of dollars of profits to pay little or no tax or actually make money off the tax system while you and I are taxed and heavily regulated. And by the way, in Free Lunch, which I hope you get and read, you will see how the government is giving money to big companies to put people like you and me out of business.
Scott, we got about 3 seconds for a response. We got to move to another caller. Scott? All right, Scott's gone. That was quite a response to Scott.
I understand Scott's view about this.
I know, I can tell.
That it is not everyone who's rich, Kathleen.
Right.
But there is a segment of the rich who are being absolutely ruthless in what they're doing.
Right.
And they are getting what they want.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott, very much for your call, as always. We go to Stella from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi.
Hi.
David, I wanted to ask you if you can explain in the opening story about the train executive whose retirement package was based. He worked for the company for 25 years,
right.
And his retirement package was based on 44 years employment. How did they do that?
Well, if you're in the government qualified pension system that applies to wages up to about $250,000 a year, you cannot do that. The way they did it for him was above that. It's an unregulated system. And so he negotiated to get this, and the board of directors gave it to him. And if you're a high-level executive, if you're a mid-level executive, $250,000 a year is a fraction of your income. Citibank had, 10 years ago, I got them to acknowledge they had more than 1,000 employees who were paid over $1 million a year. They have thousands of employees. How many, I don't know. If you're making $1 million a year, the first $250,000 is a minority of your income. So it was done simply by regulation, and the rules are pretty open about this. There are lots of executives who do this. They get paid for many more years than they work.
I'm sorry, Stella.
Yep. Lie about it?
No, it's just he said, I want to have a retirement credit for 44 years of service instead of 25, and the board of directors said, okay, we're going to do that for you. I've read innumerable executive contracts or, in most cases, the disclosure of what's in the contract that is buried in the fine print, and this is a very common feature with an executive, particularly if you come at midlife. You know, you're 50 years old and you switch companies. And the company says, well, we're going to treat you as if we hired you when you were 25.
Right. Thanks. Yeah, that happens all the time, right? Ha. Huh. Thanks, Stella,
for
the call.
Executive.
Yeah, exactly. David, thank you. You just do wonderful work. I love having you on the air. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you. David K. Johnston, he is an investigative journalist and author, senior tax reporter with the New York Times for a number of years. Well, the article that we were talking about is in the current, let me just get the first page here. It's Pension Privateers. It's Monday, May 4, 2009 is when it's posted on motherjones.com. We didn't get to all of the complex ways in which he says money is taken from from you, and Washington is full of people who are very well paid to figure out complex ways for that to happen. So it's worth a whole read. You may recall, if you're wondering, where have I heard that guy before? We had him on talking about the physical therapy article that he wrote. It's a great article in the January 4 issue of Mother Jones as well. He's quite a writer. And of course, we'll have him on again when his new book comes out. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We do want to thank all of you who supported Wisconsin Public Radio during our One Day Wednesday spring membership drive. We had more than 4,300 members contributing over $420,000 to support Wisconsin Public Radio and programming like this that you love. And we love doing. It was a record fundraising day for Wisconsin Public Radio, so we sure want to say thank you so much. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9 for All Things Political here on the Ideas Network.